everyone, welcome back to the Earthdawn Survival Guide, the podcast for all disciplines, paths, players, and game masters. With your questers, Josh and Dan, I am Dan.
I am Josh.
And on today's podcast, we will be discussing all things quizzical and fanatical, because after we handle some emails, we'll be getting to the Iron Legacy today.
Yeah.
And if you have any questions for us about anything you're going to hear, anything you'd like us to talk about, or anything else, by the way, please contact us at edsgpodcast@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail. We'll take those as well, because I believe our first email actually comes in from a guy who left us a voicemail a couple of episodes ago. So this one comes from Chris. He says, greetings from the UK. I will not attempt to copy his accent because I'm going to get it wrong no matter what I do. So I'm going to read this as me, but it's from Chris. Thanks for the podcast, which I've been voraciously devouring as a new player to Earthdawn. The how would you create an alchemist discipline question has been in my head since it came up, though I wouldn't play one, so I'm sharing with you to get it out of my head. My approach would be to broaden alchemist out to become a knowledgeable expert. Many of the historical famous alchemists, Sir Isaac Newton, were polymaths with an understanding of a wide range of sciences, often pushing back frontiers on multiples of these. Some were more reclusive, some traveled widely to see other places or measure the size of the planet, some were charlatans. Most had to make their own tools. Glass blowing really took off. But of course, that is historical. An Earthdawn alchemist would be an adept, in tune with the magic that makes the world work, and should be able to see and understand threads and patterns, if not necessarily manipulate them. Not a spellcaster, not a mundane scientist. So, for talents, apart from alchemy, I'd suggest one knowledge skill as a talent, item history, craftsman as a talent, or astral sight, evidence analysis. Some option skills might include perception ones that affect combat due to heightened understanding, such as anticipate blow and spot armor flaw. Probably another knowledge skill as a talent at each tier. Awareness, arcane mutterings, forgery as a talent, probably a journeyman rather than novice. An ability at probably journeyman would allow spending of karma on any knowledge skill test. I'd add some talents that allow identifying a creature, strengths, or weaknesses, which can be shared with the group as a higher tier talent to reduce the effect of enemy defense target, rather than adding combat skills to increase it. Just a few ideas. Clearly, as a person with one session experience in Earthdawn, I'm no expert. Cheers, Chris.
Thank you, Chris. I like how you are looking to historical alchemists for inspiration, particularly ones sort of in the Enlightenment era and so forth, the natural philosophers and whatnot. My only feeling on that is that your summary of kind of what they would be about and the talents that they have listed has me go, well, you can pretty much do that already with a, depending on exactly what kind of slant you want to take, weaponsmith or troubadour or wizard. There's nothing in that concept that stands out as being something special or unique that is not covered already by a particular approach to an existing discipline. I mean, yes, maybe you don't want it to be a spellcaster, but weaponsmith or wizard would probably be the top choices that I would have taking that approach to things, with troubadour maybe being kind of a second place. And most of those talents are available as options. So, I appreciate the thought that people have going into it, but it again comes back to the question of, okay, they get alchemy as a talent, but there's nothing else special that is showing up that screams, we need to have its own special thing in order to do this.
Yeah, fair enough. But I love your creativity and your passion and your insight. So by all means, keep good thoughts coming. We'll see what else you can come up with. On to email number two. Dan and Josh, as a longtime Earthdawn player and fan, I have found your podcast to be really insightful, delightful, enjoyable, and great. Thank you both. I have put off sending you my questions in an attempt to not have a repeat question from an earlier episode. I'm mostly caught up, and I think I'm in the clear. But before my questions, the Outcast Warrior pop culture references seemed like they were kind of hard to pin down what a perfect example would be. And it seemed like you guys were looking for more references. Ask and you shall receive. The one I was shouting out at the time was Val Kilmer's Mad Mardigan from Willow. Later,
I have not seen that movie in ages. I keep sort of meaning to show it to my kids, but haven't gotten around to it. So I don't remember it well enough to have any take on that. But I'll keep that in mind if we actually do see it.
Yeah, I've seen it once and don't recall much about it in the last 30 years. Later, after thinking about it, I came up with these two examples, which probably fit even better. Tom Cruise's Captain Algren from The Last Samurai and Ashitaka from the animated movie Princess Mononoke.
Ashitaka is actually a really, really good one. That is a good reference now that you mention it. Yeah, I think that one's pretty cool. Although the reason that Ashitaka is exiled does not really have to do with a matter of honor. The key part of the outcast warrior is that they are outcast because of that honorable choice that they made. Whereas Ashitaka happens to be an exile who holds himself to a pretty high standard of honor. But still, yeah, I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah. I've seen The Last Samurai, but I don't
I have seen The Last Samurai ages ago. It's the Tom Cruise character, so it's the one white guy in the entire cast of Japanese folks.
Yeah.
I don't remember the movie well enough for his character to comment on it, but it always feels like, oh, a samurai is such a gimme whenever you start talking about honor and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't remember enough of the storyline to know whether there's an applicable approach there.
Fair. I liked the soundtrack more than the movie, so I bought the soundtrack. But anyway, we'll get on with the rest. Questions. One, in the episode 16, Weapon Smith overview, Josh mentioned while discussing the fifth circle karma ability, where Smith may add karma on a damage test while using a weapon the Smith crafted. It is often house-ruled or assumed the weaponsmith can still gain this benefit from a weapon they have worked on with forged weapon, which makes total sense, and we now use this rule at our table. Now, the ninth circle discipline ability, Bloodbound Forge, is it acceptable to play this the same way, allowing the smith to take advantage of this cool ability on weapons and or armor the smith has worked on with forged armor or forged weapon?
Yeah, sure. The point of the house ruling is mostly to make it easier to use so that it's an ability that actually has some applicability. And I don't see any reason to not allow that for the ninth circle ability if you're allowing it for the fifth.
Yeah, that makes sense. Question number two. Fourth edition made it very clear that it is a very difficult and very rare thing to be able to detect the presence of a horror mark on a name giver. Josh has mentioned a few times the Yurupa book is a future or current project of his. In Yurupa, the centerpiece of the temple gardens is the legendary blue rose. It is said that the flowers burn with a cold blue light whenever a horror-marked individual approaches it. I sort of figured Josh would be the leading authority to ask, is this still a reliable method to detect a horror mark?
No comment. No, let me... Yurupa is a current project. It is still in the kind of very early outlining and writing stages. No release date, no idea when it would be out. I hope to have it done so that we can release it sometime next year, maybe sooner, but I don't anticipate that life is going to be kind enough to me to allow that to happen. I've got a pretty cool freelancer that I'm working with, and we're kind of dividing up the writing duties and whatnot, but we don't have much in the way of actual word count down yet. So again, what I would like to have happen and what is actually going to happen are completely different things.
Yeah. The legendary blue rose.
So we are aware of the blue rose. It is in our outlines. It is in our notes. It is something that we are aware of. My only comment at this point is to actually highlight how it is said that this thing happens. The accuracy of such a detail for a legendary, unique sort of thing remains to be seen, but it is at the moment tied into one of the themes that we're hoping to explore in the book.
Fair. Question number three. The second Circle Illusionist spell, Mind Fog, if an Imgiver were running for their life and the spell was successfully cast upon them, would they come to a complete stop, or would they continue running but not remember why they were running?
I would be inclined toward the latter, personally.
Okay.
Which might make it easy to convince them to stop running while the effect was still in place, but I don't know that I would necessarily have them immediately stop.
Gotcha. Follow-up questions. If they do come to a complete stop, being unable to do anything until they have a successful willpower test to break the spell, would they get the cumulative +5 per round bonus due to the adrenaline stress of the situation, even if they are not actually in combat?
That yeah, I would specific. Be inclined to provide that bonus. That's a really sort of circumstantial situation, but if somebody is really fleeing for their life and they forget the immediate threat, but they still have that physiological response in place, I would imagine that they would be trying to figure out why it is that they are having this heightened response to whatever's going on.
Yeah, a little bit of real world in there. Lastly, would there be any way to stop an illusionist from having mind fog in an enhanced matrix and cast it on a target round after round in an attempt to CC them through a fight?
CC stands for crowd control.
Crowd control. Thank you. Sorry.
Also sometimes referred to as stun locking or whatever kind of situation. Just basically casting the spell over and over to make sure that they aren't capable of doing anything.
Gotcha. It wasn't up on my vernacular.
Technically, especially
the case of a boss fight, he says.
Yeah. That just feels cheesy. It just feels wrong.
It feels video gamey. I'm just going to sit here and pummel you and pummel you and pummel you and pummel you.
Yeah, I mean, that's a situation where definitely some bonuses would be likely to come into play. Hold on, let me... Okay, Mind Fog is only second circle.
Yeah. So yeah, the question is, would there be any way to stop an illusionist from having Mind Fog in an enhanced matrix and cast it on a target round after round?
There's nothing that would stop it, but if the idea is to lock down an enemy for a combat, what I would do is rather than have it reset the +5 bonus each time the spell is cast, just have that bonus accumulate. Because you can't have multiple effects of the same spell. Like, they don't stack.
Mm-hmm.
First off, I would talk and say, hey, this is kind of a degenerate strategy. This is kind of a cheesy strategy. Mm-hmm. I would approach it from that direction first. But the second thing would be, if that's what you want to do, then that cumulative +5, because each round in combat, the target gains a +5 cumulative bonus to their willpower test to shake off the effect. I would just have that cumulative total just keep ramping up rather than allowing the multiple castings of the spell to basically reset that bonus every round or every other round or whatever the situation was.
So first round +5, second round +10, third round +15.
And also the spell doesn't prevent the individual from defending themselves, right? Mm-hmm. Appropriately defending yourself against hooligans is considered a reaction. They might not know why they are being attacked or why they or, you know, what the circumstances are. But if they are being attacked, they are able to defend themselves. And I would say that would include casting spells or striking with weapons or whatever. It's not just defensive stuff. Their tactics might change slightly depending on the exact circumstances and where they might not remember exactly why they are doing what they're doing. But if you cast a spell and they forget that and you attack them, then they can fight back. It's not a way to prevent the boss from doing anything to you.
Yeah. They're not just stunned and hanging out.
Yeah, it's not a stun lock. It doesn't prevent them from doing anything. It just means that they don't remember exactly what it was that they were trying to do. So, yeah, somebody who might be trying to escape would forget why they were trying to escape, right? But they don't forget who they are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they just kind of forget in that moment what's going on. But it doesn't prevent them from, oh, these people are attacking me. I don't understand why. Well, I guess I better defend myself. Fireball, fireball, fireball.
For lack of a better example, yes.
Yeah, and if it's getting really bad, then I would just have that plus five bonus while in combat continue to stack and not be reset by individual castings of the spell.
Fair enough.
Okay. But again, like, approach it out of game first. I understand why you're trying to do what you want to do, in a sense, yeah, maybe, and that is to, quote unquote, win the encounter, to find a strategy that can't be beat. It reminds me of a D&D game that I ran back in the third edition days, where one of the players made a thief whose shtick was basically having a ring of invisibility. Like, I think it was a ring of invisibility and boots of haste, or some kind of like magical item combo that would, in theory, allow them to disappear. And then because they're invisible, that means they trigger their sneak attack ability again.
Mm-hmm.
Looking for a situation where they could minimize the risk that they had while trying to put out tons and tons of damage. And the trouble is that there's a bunch of stuff that was not susceptible to sneak attack damage. And so in situations where that combo didn't work, they had invested so much into getting that combo that they weren't capable of operating particularly well outside of it, and would get very frustrated in a sense because they felt that their thing was being denied.
Mm-hmm. Well, you build it for a situation. That situation is not there.
Yeah. You're
at a disadvantage now.
You know, mind fog is not a stun lock. It doesn't prevent the boss from trying to smack you. They just might not know in the moment why they are doing it, except perhaps that, oh, these people are trying to hit me, so I'm going to hit them back.
Yeah. You'll still trigger the fight or flight response.
Yeah.
You may not like either one. So, yeah. Question four. The fourth circle illusionist spell, notice not. Does this actually make the caster invisible, or will name givers be able to see the caster but just not notice them or what they are about until they disturb the environment somehow?
It doesn't make them invisible. It just makes them kind of not be noticed unless
they kind of blend
something
into the background a little bit.
Yeah. Unless something happens that would potentially trigger, say, a sensing test. If they are interacting with the environment in some way, I mean, the spell is going to do a certain amount to try and have people rationalize why something is going on, but it does not make them invisible. And the spell explicitly does not protect against any form of astral sensing, unlike some illusions where that is built in. You know, in fact, in the description, if the target interacts with anything in the area, onlookers may make a sensing test as appropriate. So it's decent. It helps. You know, it can help in certain circumstances, but it's not an invisibility spell.
Yeah. It's more like, hey, where did I leave my doohickey? Oh, if it was a snake, it would have bit you because it was right there and you just didn't notice it. My group is enjoying 4th edition. I would say that it is easily my favorite edition of Earthdawn. Thank you, Josh and the development team, for all your hard work. And thank you, Dan, for making the EDSG podcast happen, for all the prep work you do in the process. Cheers. Aaron, P.S. Please forgive any grammatical errors or typos. Being an art major, writing and typing has never been my strong suit.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the kind words, and I'm sure the rest of the team does as well.
I do, too. Email number three. This is from Andy. Hi, both. So far, we have survived two sessions an hour, looks likely. Horror struck care. In case you hadn't noticed, Chris, from the voice message and email, is playing the Obsidian Warrior in our group. Chris was two emails ago. I had been singing the praises of the podcast, and as you can see, it worked. Anyway, on to a few questions. As adepts circle up, how much does their astral pattern change, or does it not? Additionally, would this make higher circle adepts stand out more on astral? The thief ability power mask seems to imply something can be hidden.
I don't think that astral sight or astral examination of an adept's pattern would be able to tell you necessarily their exact circle. I think that for me is a little bit too specific a detail that could be gleaned from that. But I think maybe with a couple of successes against the adept's mystic defense on an astral sight test, you might be able to tell maybe what tier they are, you know, novice, journeyman, warden, master, or maybe even you know, again, with sufficient number of successes, maybe even be low journeyman or high journeyman or, you know, something along those lines.
Yeah.
For me, a big part of astral sight and astral sensing has to do with what information is being looked for at the time of the examination and what relevance it might have to the story that is being told at that time. In theory, there is a whole lot of information that could potentially be learned from astral examination given sufficient time to do so, but how much of it is strictly relevant to what is going on at the moment? One of the things that I sort of have in mind is Monster of the Week, for example, which is a Powered by the Apocalypse game that I'm kind of familiar with. I play in a game of it,
yeah,
where there is a move called Investigate a Mystery, and you make a roll, and based on your success, you have a list of questions that you can ask. That's like a list of 5 or 6 questions, like, you know, what kind of creature is it? Where did it go? What is being concealed here? There's a couple of others like that. And that the number of those questions on that list that you can ask are determined by how successful your role is. If you look at perception tests in, for example, or awareness tests in the Legends of Barsave adventures, or in other adventures as well, there is typically a table that indicates what kind of information you can learn from the scene based on the number of successes that are rolled against the base difficulty number. Examining somebody's pattern as a GM, if you are coming up with the adventure, you need to sort of decide what the clues are and use the success level to maybe provide additional details. I feel like I'm kind of wandering far afield here of the original question now. No. But yeah, generally speaking, a more powerful adept will have a pattern that reflects that greater power, and it would be possible for somebody who understands such things to look at it and kind of come to some conclusions based on their examination, given sufficient time to devote to that.
Yeah, fair. But not a quick cursory one-round glance into astral space. Not enough time. Secondly, is there any reason not to use a shield as a magician? I've deliberately avoided initiative penalties, but I can't see a reason I wouldn't use a buckler. Many thanks as ever, Andy.
I don't think there's any reason to avoid doing it unless for some reason the spell descriptions that the motions that are described as part of casting the spell would be not possible with a shield. But I don't see any reason why you couldn't have a buckler to do that. No, there are no discipline-based armor or weapon restrictions at all. So grab that buckler, give yourself a +1 to your physical defense, especially if you're a magician. You generally don't like it when things get up close and personal with you, and giving yourself a little bit of an extra bonus can be handy.
I'm playing a group right now with a dwarf elementalist, and he is wearing full plate armor. He absolutely goes last. If he rolls anything higher than a 0 on initiative, we're impressed. One of those things. Last email, and then on to all things fanatical. So, hello, Josh and Dan. This is from Jonathan. Always enjoying the show. I'm very fond of the episodes you do about the secret societies. I'm a longtime fan of Earthdawn, but I never took the time to read about them. Not because I was not interested. I was just postponing for many reasons. So thank you. I can now put my attention to it without much effort. Since January, I started a new campaign where I converted a popular module from D&D. I had fun figuring where to put everything and substituting elements with Barsavian culture. Now the players are nearing the end of the module, and I was wondering how to stretch this setting for further adventures. And then you started making episodes about secret societies. And I have to say, at every episode, I end up with the feeling like, oh yeah, I need to put that in my campaign. I am now overwhelmed by ideas on how to flesh out a bit more my antagonists, so thanks for the hand up. Now here's a question for Josh. Speaking of antagonists, have you ever thought about making paths or things alike for those secret societies and other organizations not really suited for players? Like Exo Lasher and Bloodwater from the Bloodwood, for instance. Thinking about the Keys of Death, I understand that death cannot grant devotions, but if a path can be formed around simple concepts like postal delivery, it wouldn't be too hard to justify a path for the Keys of Death. Same goes for the Hand of Corruption. I know these things need a lot of development before they can be put into a book. The question is more, did the subject ever happen in conversation at FASA? Thank you, Jonathan.
Well, thank you, Jonathan. No, there have not been any discussions of creating paths for antagonist groups like that. From a conceptual standpoint, I absolutely think that it is possible for them to have a path that might grant them some special abilities, but I don't think we would ever see anything published in terms of a full path write-up for them, simply because it's not something that we would want to make available to player characters.
Yeah.
I can conceptually think of a campaign where you might be playing a member of the Keys of Death or something like that, but it's really atypical, and I don't believe anymore in the idea of having bad guys, having opposition necessarily follow the exact rules that player characters do. If I want to have a group like the Keys of Death that have this unusual magical trait that they learn as a result of their pursuit of this goal, or as a result of their membership in this organization, then I, as a GM, can just kind of come up with it and have it be something that comes up from time to time again, and without needing to do a full path write-up or everything, just kind of hand wave it. And if it comes up to be a question, say, yeah, it appears to be some kind of weird path magic, but because of the oaths and restrictions and requirements that are involved in any kind of path, you don't really know anything about it, right? Yeah, you're not able to really learn much about it. If you take a look at Morgan's website, Panda Gaming Grove, there are multiple examples that he's put together on there of adepts statted out similar to the way that you would, that we stat out creatures, that rather than have them be a full character write up with all of the talents and everything that would be available, they have a list of special abilities that behave very similarly to some talents. Generally, this is like for a situation where you wouldn't have them be a full recurring NPC or something like that, where they're just like, they're going to be sort of lackeys who happen to be swordmasters of the bad guy. And so we give them some abilities that make them feel sword mastery, rather than we've got to decide that he is, you know, sixth circle, which means that we've got to decide what all of his optional talents are and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
For a character that's not going to be a long-term antagonist, we don't really care what his thread weaving is. Like, it's not going to matter.
No.
And I really think that that's the kind of prep that hinders things more for a GM than it does helping. I absolutely understand the need to have sort of stat blocks for opposition that the characters might interact with or fight or whatever, but you don't need to have a full character created for an adept that is potentially going to be just a one-off.
Fair enough. Thank you, one and all, for the slew of emails we got, the whole batch of questions and hypotheticals you proposed to Josh. And thank you, Josh, for all the answers, by the way. I don't think I could have come up with anything nearly as poignant as you said. So all at your feet, sir. I'm just co-hosting over here. So with that all out of the way, by the way, folks, one more reminder, if you have any questions for us, edsgpodcast@gmail.com, and we will get back to you when we get a chance. By the way, we did get one more email, but we will not read it on air because it was a group adventuring journal. And
yeah,
it was a lovely read. I really enjoyed that whole read. It was nice to see someone else's take on what was happening with their adventuring group. And I like those little stories. So
it was really cool to read, and we appreciated that. And it's just too long to put on the on the show here.
Yeah. And no one wants to hear me ramble on anybody's story, really. So on to all things Fanatical. This is the Iron Legacy. And this is probably one of my favorite essays I've read out of the Secret Societies of Barsaves. It's very well written. And
yeah,
whoever wrote this really understood orcs. And so it just tugged on the strings of like, yeah, orcs are getting the raw end of the deal on this one again, because this is a secret society, a cult, basically, dedicated to the Mad Passion Dis, and mostly their interest in slavery and mastery, not the other aspects involved in Dis. This is that one little facet of Dis about slavery and mastery, because really they're trying to return all orcs to slavery. And this is Dis's active opposition to the Passion Locust.
Yeah. This is the third Mad Passion cult that is in the book. There's one for Ragok, the Crown Breakers. There's one for Vestrial, which we talked about before. The Whisperers?
I think you're right, the Whisperers. You are correct. Whisperers is Vestrial. No problem. You had it. You had it right.
And then this is the third of them, the one dedicated to Dis, specifically focused on their aspect of slavery, especially focused on the legacy of orcs being the slave race and looking to break them, and especially focused in this case on Carafod as the orc nation. This group's focus, while not exclusively on Carafod, is very highly focused on the orc nation and looking to tear it down in some capacity.
Yeah. Since this was published about the time when the Prelude to War was coming out, there obviously at the moment has not been a fourth edition update to this secret society. But this was around the time that Carafod was getting founded and mass pilgrimages were being made by orcs of other parts of Barsave in the province to get to Carafod. And so this probably is ripe for the picking for any game master to use to update for their own campaign, now that the timeline's been advanced a little bit, and you can probably throw some more interactions on there. At this time, a little bit back in Earthdawn's past, this was founded by and is led by a quester of Dis himself, Talirin, whatever, Kale, and he really, really hates orcs. He wants them all dead or in chains, and his efforts really are, at this point, focused on destroying Carafod. Clearly, with the advance of the timeline, he wasn't entirely successful, but doesn't mean he's stopped trying or that he's dead. So he's raiding Scorcher Bands as a kind of a retribution, I think, in my words, not the essay's words, because he was coming out of a care that was raided by Scorchers, and they were in the full-blown Gahad, and so they were like berserker crazed, and so he really kind of was scarred by that and has not overcome that. And he's hoping to demoralize orcs entirely throughout Barsave, if he can bring down the entire orc nation. So those are his main goals right there.
Yeah. This is similar to the Crown Breakers, an organization that is dedicated to a particular goal. And if you've got a campaign that is heavily focused in some way around Carafod or the orcs, they would absolutely be an appropriate antagonist group to bring into play. You certainly could expand their idea to deal with slavery in a broader sense, but this is a case where, much like the Crown Breakers, there is a particular individual that is driven to this objective, not as a sort of broad overarching goal dictated to them by their patron passion, but more like, because I had this traumatic experience at the hands of orcs, I am a damaged in some way and am taking that out, and the passion is empowering me in order to further this because I am devoted to them in pursuit of this ideal that is related. And so it is a case of a group that really could be involved either as a major force or just a kind of recurring organization that shows up in any kind of game that revolves around Karafod to some extent. I don't recall now off the top of my head whether they come into play. They do, actually. Does the Iron Legacy come into play in Empty Thrones?
Oh, no, sorry.
There's that whole storyline that takes place down on the border of Karafod and Landis.
Well, the Iron Legacy is not listed in the index, but...
Yes, okay. One of the NPCs in Empty Thrones, and one who doesn't, like, come into play sort of directly in the events there, but does get mentioned and is used as a potential spoiler or complication or whatever, is affiliated with the Iron Legacy and could cause problems in terms of the overall story of what's going on. The basic premise is that the Iron Legacy is still around and operating.
Yeah.
Making a reference to the Karafod book, which came out after Secret Societies.
Yeah.
And kind of goes from there. So when you've got an organization that is devoted to a mad passion, there's no reason for us to have decided that they aren't around anymore. And so they are still around.
Yeah. Why take out one of the toys in the sandbox?
Right. Exactly.
So if you are familiar with Prelude to War, this is kind of where the Iron Legacy got its foundation. The beginning of the rise of the Orc Nation here as well. But yes, Talyrin, T-A-L-Y-R-I-N, like the spelling, no idea how to pronounce it, is also destroying vital supplies of established villages, burning crops, poisoning water, more, you know, subjugation methods, famine, thirst, hunger, whatnot. So he's really dedicated to either enslaving orcs or wiping them off the face of the earth. And members of the Iron Legacy are all led by little tiny bands here and there, are led by questers of Dis, but most of them are just, you know, thugs, your typical average bigots. Most members are humans, a couple elves, a few dwarves, very handful of Tuskrang, but you will not find windlings or obsidian involved in the Iron Legacy at all.
You also will not find any orcs because the organization is absolutely dedicated against them.
Yeah.
Also trolls. It's mentioned in the essay in the game information section that orcs, obsidian, trolls, and windlings, you will not find any of them among their number. Although you could potentially make a case that you might have an exception that would show up there.
Yeah, good luck with that. There are a few adepts, of course, because they'll not just gather farm people and passersby. So every once in a while, somebody might be an adept of some discipline. Doesn't really matter what you want to use. So this is kind of free form, very flexible. As Josh said, you can use it for minor encounters, repeated encounters, major encounters. If you want to put them behind the major plot of something, by all means, they're free to do so. One of Teller and Kale's favorite tactics is to fly Scorcher colors so that the victims, any left alive, would blame Karafod and or Orc Scorcher bands to increase the hatred, therefore, of orcs. So it's kind of the deceptive part to his tactics.
Yeah. Again, sort of minor spoilers for Empty Thrones, because it is a story that revolves around the tensions on the Karafod-Landis border. The operations of the Iron Legacy in that area are mainly intended to continue to inflame the tensions between those groups. And again, like potentially cause problems and things like that in terms of how that goes on.
Yeah, fair. So this is a pretty straightforward group. They're built on hatred and bigotry. They are dedicated to the Mad Passion Dis. They are led by questers of Dis, and they gather as many people as they possibly can to increase their ranks. And that's it. It's very sinister. It's not complex. It's it's cut and dried.
There's not much going on here. Unlike some other organizations where you could conceivably come up with a complex reason for why, you know, or have an interesting situation in terms of what's going on.
Mystery.
The Hand of Corruption, you know, when we talked about them, I talked about how you could have an interesting villain or adversary from that group that has philosophical discussions, perhaps, and might have motivations that on some level are kind of understandable. That's not the case with the Iron Legacy. The Iron Legacy are basically a bunch of, pardon my French, racist shitheads.
Yeah, there you go.
That are dedicated to either enslaving or eradicating the orcs. They're bad guys, and there's no real question. Their motivations are not complex. I mean, perhaps
they're
in some regard
superficial.
Yeah. I mean, in some regard, there is perhaps a little bit of tragedy in terms of the background of how they came to be when it comes to Talyrin and how he is motivated to do what he does.
One bad experience.
Yeah. Because of the eradication of the care that he was from at the hands of a bunch of shitty orcs.
Yeah.
But in the end, he's making the choice to do what he is at this point and is perhaps in some way both driving and being driven by the Mad Passion Dis. Mm-hmm. But he's painting with a broad brush and taking out his anger and grief on a whole bunch of innocent people.
Yep.
And so it's beyond the point where there's anything potentially redemptive about it. And he's empowering a whole bunch of other awful people to do awful things.
Yeah. I wish there were more nuance, but sometimes you just need a blunt instrument. And this is the Iron Legacy is a blunt instrument.
They don't need more nuance.
No, we have other groups for that.
Yeah, potentially. But yeah, this is a group. The orcs of Earthdawn are wonderful. I love them culturally. I love the story that's involved with them, despite some of the potentially problematic stuff that can come up as a result of the parallels that one might wish to draw between historical whatever. And bringing the Iron Legacy in is likely to make that parallel even more blatant. But again, these are just a bunch of awful people that are empowered by a mad passion and just want to kill and or enslave the people of this nation, and they should be smashed into the dirt.
Yeah, like I said, it's sometimes you need the blunt instrument for the story. This is them. I think the simplest secret society we've talked about, but you know, they're there. It's what they are. Sometimes you need that as an antagonistic foil, and sometimes you don't. So if you want to use them, there's three adventure hooks to kind of get you in there. One is very, very, very simple. The other two have a little bit more nuance to them. But really, you know, they're not going to be the ones that are going to have some major political intrigue behind what they're doing. This is Talyrin Kale, especially, is a blunt object as a character to achieve his means and his ends.
Yeah.
So with that, folks, we'll kind of wrap this one up, get on to the next one. And otherwise, if you have any questions for us about anything you heard tonight, or again, if this sparks some ideas for you about how you may have used any one of our secret societies in the past, we'd love to hear those tales and read those stories, whether they're meant for air or not, depends upon the length. But feel free to contact us again at edsgpodcast@gmail.com. We really do love interacting with everybody, and all your ideas and thoughts are very welcome. Until next time, don't be too fanatical about your legend.
Good night, everybody.